is almost like living in the past. When I was doing all my music, called me the late Mizzy, and I never really knew what was my habits or my condition, but sometimes I'm a little earlier than others, but this is an exceptional, you know. I had no idea that the airport was so that far away. I mean, I've been complaining about California, but you've got a seat. I went to my... Anyhow, my name is Mia. I'm a wife now. I can brag on this. I have any time said, and all grateful for you, one. And primarily, I guess, because when I came, when I came down, that's when my troubles really started. Now, that's sometimes hard for people to believe, but it's the truth. Because when I came down, I had three or four answers for any given situation. Not work, but it was a regular tactic of disaster that usually followed. And when I got down, there was one answer, and that was my sponsors. And usually it was face reality, you know. I'll tell you very frankly, I was not completely hoping, but kind of wishing that maybe I knew what I was going to do when I got up here. Because this is first for me. And I do what I usually do when I'm asked to do something that I don't want to do. I called her to find out if you were a friendly group. Because I figured she would have a life I had a halfway chance. And then I called Arvita's O'Neill in Texas because she's going to be doing the same thing in California. And neither one of them helped me a lot, so I called my sponsor. And I don't call her in a very desperate situation. And I said to her, I don't know how to get myself into these damn things. And she said, I know. And I said, wow, she's here always talking when she's listening. So I said, well, what do you think I should do? And she said, pray. And I did, all the way up here. But when Dave first told me that the theme of this conference or retreat or whatever you call it was to be celebrate each day, I like that. Because my method of celebrating each day now, since I have been Al-Anon, is to work it through the 12 steps and the 4 traditions. Because each day to me today is a celebration. And she also mentioned the fact that a gal by the name of Bunny was instrumental in getting something like this started. And, you know, there has to be something very special in people who can get a room like this together, spend 3 days and go and still talk to one another. Because whether you realize it or not, I realize it. If anybody had told me a few hundred years ago that I would be spending a weekend with this many women, I said, you gotta be nuts. You know, those were the days of competition. Those were the days when I had to compete for whatever reason. You know, there was no celebration in those kind of days. I got out in October 1957 on a love and alone. But that's what I did. See, I was afraid of people. Not necessarily that I would be hurt, but that they might find out that I cared something about them. And that was the only weapon that anybody had they used against me. And that was the fact that if you found out that I liked you or that I cared about you, whether you were a friend or whether you were a relative, it meant that you had a weapon that you could use against me, and I was constantly afraid that you would. When I got to Al-Anon, most of you know I didn't come for good reasons. It was letting my husband vote that got me to Al-Anon, and I wasn't altogether happy about that either, because this was a strange bunch of people, as far as I was concerned. You know, one thing they stood and talked about things that they had behind fears, you know, and it didn't seem to be the least ashamed of. I really had a few genuine doubts about whether or not this was the type of an organization that my family would approve me belonging to. There's something about what goes on in a meeting and between individuals in a meeting that is almost captivating, at least it was to me, because it aroused in me a desire to have what you want, to have what you have, and go and things together. That's a quote out of a big book, that's all right. When I came to Al-Anon, we used a big book about Alcoholics Anonymous because we didn't have a lot of literature. We had 5 pieces, one printed in Toronto, one in Tucson, one in LA, and 2 from New York. We had a book about that big. That didn't say a lot, but they managed to make a lot of pamphlets out of it. And then he had a big book of AA. And so I'm kind of geared towards there not being necessarily any kind of separation between the Al-Anon and the alcoholic, because it's but the grace of God that I could have been on the other side. Because you could believe me, if I had to do the alcohol had done for me what it did for him, I'd have gotten drunk. Because it just seemed to me like he didn't have a care in the world. I tried it. I tried it drunk all the time. It didn't help me. It just made it harder for me to do what I had to do. And it sort of generated less cooperation, too, from people that were around me, because I was not happy drunk. I was a traveling drunk. Now, I don't know if you react to that or not, but I do step a little too hard, and she'll take off never land. And that's true, you know. I get an idea in my head. I should have called someone from San Francisco, and too late, Tom, so I'll just drive by. You know, I really don't have too much trouble with some of the things that Eddie has done today, because he's one of those people that drink, and that's out, but not me. I either telephone, or I went, one of the two. I guess it's no surprise that I identified more with alcoholics than I did with women. And I used to love to mention that I liked to drink during days that I was drinking, because I like to watch some of the Al-Anon swarm. I don't know if you ever noticed or not, when they come into Al-Anon, they're new. I don't speak for Al-Anon because I haven't had a chance to observe the alcoholic. But when the Al-Anon first comes in to an Al-Anon meeting, one thing she don't want you to think she's ever had is a good time. Yeah. Because no self-respecting martyr ever had a good time. And I can say that with all honesty because that's the way I was. You know, I went in my first Al-Anon meeting as a conversation to help them. Because that's sort of the way my sponsor had introduced me to it. I've talked a lot of times, I've mentioned well on occasion, but in my day, you didn't pick a sponsor. I gave you one. And it was primarily because I didn't say that Al-Anon was underground, but there were so few meetings that you know where they were. And so Wilma actually was chosen to me by God, because the gal got the original call to make a post-it call and we had an air appointment. We were very dedicated in those days, I guess. And besides that, she lived a little distance away, and so she called Wilma and asked Wilma if she would call and see me. That's how I got her. And as some of you know, the first day she came to my house, she found the front door shut, which was necessary. I mean, I was in a shit to cover 2 doors. I was really kind of worn out. And she finally came back that night, and she was scared, I think, because she had gone next door to ask this neighbor whether or not I was at home, and the neighbor had implied that I was crazy. And so it kind of scared her. When she came back that night, she brought a friend with her. And I never saw the girl from that night ever again. I mean, then the Wilma. I think it scared her, too, you know, because they were in my house, I don't know how, and I had all these little bodies running around, because I used to get my kids to bed on the production days. I'd come all in tub, get a washer in the shower, I'd dress in bed, so I had a little time to worry. And besides that, I had always, you know, some of my messages to a favorite husband, I'd always say, if you attend to see your children before they go to bed, you had better be here on time. And I'd hurry up and get those kids ready to go to bed before I had a cat to get home. And they would usually just have to see from my way, mother would go out and find out where he was. And maybe that's one of the reasons that I'm a firm believer that in my particular case, my kids never react to the alcoholic, they always react to my reacting to the alcoholic. Because they never knew whether they were going to get up. But one came back that night and told me how sick I was. But you know, what she actually told me was that I had tried something I didn't even know I had. And told me a lot of other people still had it. And she was going to get together and help me in the group. That's sort of the way it sounded to me. But I didn't know what you're talking about. See, I didn't comprehend anything that was going on that I didn't initiate. Now, I don't know if that makes sense or not, but if you understand it, you're in the right place. I tell you that for sure. But it just went right out of my head, you know. And I didn't know mine for being willingly. I went because I told her I would have her these other people she was having trouble with. And she took me to my first meeting in Azusa, California. Believe it or not, it was in the back room of a place I had once threatened to burn down. And you talk about fear. And she turned into that drug that bounced fail on the side because I thought they sent her. You know, somebody knew. You know, it's just suspicious and fearful, you know. And if you're a woman that loved a woman, you have problems. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. But I have often said, and it's true, I hope I never get that need, because I had that feeling of walking from a world of absolute chaos into a place of absolute peace. So I didn't have to explain my existence. And that was something that I had never been able to do. You know, one of the things that has attracted me to Al-Anon and get me here is the fact that this is some place that I can be myself. This is a place where I don't have to be something or somebody that I think you think I ought to be. Now, there's a little riff for you if you understand that you're in the right place. Because, when I got to Al-Anon, I really didn't know who I was. You know, I had a name, that's true, but I never had an identity. I was always somebody's wife, somebody's mother, somebody's daughter, somebody's grandmother, somebody's something. But I never really knew who I was. And I remember asking my sponsor one night, how do you find out who you are? And she said to me, because I had a very sick sponsor, you're going to hear more about it this weekend. When I asked her that question, she said to me, well, in your case, how do you serve it? You understand that? I didn't. But I told her, you know, that's why you're a pretty good size piece of steady, even as far as children are concerned, among other people over me, but most kind of reason. And she said, that's what does. That's the way you live your life, too. And I said, what do you mean? She said, you take a big chunk of your life and you give it in. I've been very even as far as the children are concerned. Once in a while, there's a small piece left over for you. But most times there isn't. And I said, well, what are you doing? Just like that. She said, take for a piece of cake. And that's what I do in the day of time to the best of my ability. Because that, too, is a way to celebrate today, or egg day, or any day. Is to be able to admit to yourself time to another human being that's entitled to a happy life on earth than anybody else. No. Because that's my own advice. I want those people who always slipped into that quiz of unworthiness. And believe you me, it was always a hard climb back up where I was able to admit that I was just as entitled to be happy as anybody else. But you see, I didn't know what happiness was when I came to Al-Anon. I didn't know what success was when I came to Al-Anon. All of those things are things that I had learned as we went along. And I won't give it all away tonight, tell you what they do tomorrow. be with me. Anyhow, one of the things that I had difficulty with when I got here, and kept saying to me, it's one day at a time. And I called her on the phone one day and I said, what do you mean one day at a time? Does that mean from the time you get the morning until the time that you go to bed? Or how I'm counting? You know, I mean, everybody counts things differently. I didn't even know what it was because I go to bed. I had to stay up, you know, because I had to get until I got home, and I had to stay up to keep him going out. It was kind of a missed deal, but of course, when I was first in Al-Anon, he was in the hospital, and so I really didn't have that worry. But we've been with bad habits hard to break, you know, and God thought fit to replace him with Al-Anon. And I had to stay up to learn how to work this program, because I wanted to do it perfectly. And at that time, I didn't have a big book, so I didn't know that we're not supposed to be perfect, we're just supposed to go along spiritual life, but I didn't know what spiritual was either. I had a lot of trouble with words, but when I asked Elma, how do you count your day? She said to me, now. I said, me now? She said, that's the day, now. I said, how can you measure now? And she said, well, you've been doing it for the last 10. Because I didn't live in now. I live in yesterday or tomorrow. I remember on New Year's Eve, back in about 1955, thinking to myself, oh my God, I've got 364 days to go through that. And you know, I was never disappointed. I always had 364 miserable days to go through before another year came along. I could say the same thing over and over again. But I had learned how to live in the now. I never have really had much chance to talk about. I'm jumping around. You can fix it all. You can fix anything. I've had people ask me sometimes about a little bit about how my husband happened to get into AA or decided to get into AA, and it's kind of an interesting story. Most of you know I hate children all day. And I usually make people tell them they crept in just like I do, so I was all surprised. And so I always say, Eddie's a little shocked too, and he's so brought up. He thought it was basic for living, but I had taken him on a disastrous trip back to the state of Missouri. Teddy Boy from California. I hated California. It was one of the largest bars I've ever been at an Asian liquor store. And we had kind of an interesting trick on deck. And even though I went out of California, I knew I would accept anybody. I didn't do anything about it because I had five children at the time. They had five children having a baby, no bill, especially if you didn't was. And well, I set up the office for him. Right, not the office with patients and everything, but I never had a minute. And then when I went to see a doctor in Kansas City, because having gone out of California, I was expecting maybe I figured I'd go out and do something, and I did. And this man was a registered individual. He was really so long. He helped me and sat down, patting on his head, and then told me I was going to have a twins. Yeah, that's what I said. I almost died in his office. I was nearly on him, you know, he was insisting on too. And I had problems that time. I had lost my dentist, left on him, and they didn't know what to do. And Besides all that, I knew Eddie was going to say my children because he said, there are no pins in my family. I got so involved in my moral character that I forgot there were twins in my family. It wasn't until after they arrived that my mother said, isn't it nice we have another set of twins? And I said, in whose family? She said, ours. I said, well, why did you tell me? She said, you better ask me. Which is true. I mean, before I found out, I never asked anything. You can bet way people find out you don't know something. And you ask them, you know? Even when I used to get lost, I'd pull into a filling station and I'd do the end. Where are you located? Because I knew that if I found out where he was, I would know where I was. And that was the whole point of the exercise. But he should not know I didn't know that I was lost. That was the whole thing. But anyhow, after the successful trip to Missouri, I decided to bring it back to California because, you know, I didn't like California. I looked how I hated Missouri. California looked pretty good. And I came back to California, and it was really rather an interesting trip. You know, I think we lived in place more than a week and a half, you know, because I'd move in, take a look around, and I saw a bar within walking distance, I'd move. And that's why I never two sons, I never could keep in school, take him to school, usually waiting for him when I got home. And I asked him whether he liked school or not after I got out, and he got out, and he said, I sure didn't, Mom. But I was always afraid you'd move while I was gone. And that really wouldn't have been unheard of because I never stayed in any place for a very long period of time. But the hammer fell when we were in Westchester, and Eddie got arrested. And that was the thing. I had always told him, you know, if he ever lost his hair, I was going to divorce him. Never thought I'd go to jail. And I have a few other things, you know, that I kept checking off because he did all of them. And finally, I see he got arrested. And I knew that this was it. I was just going to have to divorce him because he had become an embarrassment to my family. None of my family had ever been jailed before that I'd love at that time. And suddenly, he ceased to be that tall, handsome, immaculate professional man we became. To be so like John Dillinger. Now, I have a very vivid imagination. You have to sort of get past that because I used to visualize him, you know, standing behind the bars with needing to shave and all that stuff, like just on the TV, you know. I wonder when he came out of jail, like, did a far vacation, because I'm the one that looked like I'd been in jail. Because, I spent 7 days that he was supposed to be in there. That's what they sent him to do, 7 days for driving under the influence. Those were in the good old days. I don't get life. But, I spent all the time writing a Dear John letter, explaining to him how it just was impossible for us to go on because of all of this stuff. And, he called me on the phone to kind of help me along with the letter, because, I just told him to ask, you know, he was probably listening on the telephone line. Now, that's paranoia, but I know I was paranoid. And, he was following police car, can you believe that? And loving it. Because he probably all night and he up sun all day on the roof of the jail. And he called me to tell me he got 2 days off because I could call your mom to fell sitting at city. Because I hadn't finished the letter yet, but I went down to look at nights. I didn't go in because one of you think I knew anybody in there. So I sat across the street like I was doing yard work at the Red Cross. And he walked out of that jail, up in that car, and he raised his hand and he said to me, I will never take another drink as long as I live. And you can believe this or not, I forgot the whole day speech. I had to practice it for 5 days. You know, you could make me up in the middle of the night and start right off what I had been writing. So anyhow, I believed to the point that I got a house out in Temple City, a house that was built for me in about 1898. Like it, one of the houses was waiting for a girl to bring it out there. Because the little lady that took me through it had gotten into it as a bride, so she thought I used to be. I thought I was. It was sort of a meeting of the mind, you might say. She went down or showed me, rather, like it was a fruit cellar or something. Yeah. Has thought, Lord, I don't. And kind of, she thinks it's a wonderful place to hide things. Not agree with the, you know, after you sharp shovel and planting the basement and all that. You know. I was the only one that looked for anyhow. But anyhow, it's when we were in this house. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about this house. It was furnished. And furniture, I think, had been there since about 1998. The only thing in the house that worked really with a piano. And I used to sit out at the piano and drop the kids to bed and compose my messages to the way husband with the music background. And there were a few keys that stuck, but I pulled out the piano long enough to find out I'd play Onward Christian Soldiers with many things didn't, you know. So after I got the kids to bed, I'd sit down and play Onward Christian Soldiers, you know. And those kids would sleep the whole time I played. But the minute I stopped, they were right awake. Because they knew either he was home or we were leaving. It was one of the two, you know. Never even had to wake him up. But it was about this time that I was feeling too well, and I didn't know what was the matter with me. I went to Arcadia to see a doctor. And of course, the thing that knew was, Missy, you already have a. And I'm like, I didn't, you know, I mean, I just couldn't understand this at all. I'm a good Catholic, but he was not it. I just couldn't quite make connection. But this doctor said one thing to me that nobody else had ever said to me before. He said, there's about 1 chance in 100 that this would be a full-term pregnancy. And that's all I heard that man say. I went out of his office knowing that I didn't know where, I didn't know when, I didn't know how, but I did know that this time I was not going to have a baby. Now, you may not believe this, but it's the gospel truth. I did not gain enough weight that anybody in my family, even my husband, knew that I was expecting a baby. A doctor in Alcoholics Anonymous told me that it's a classic case of self-hypnosis. That you can believe something so strongly in your own mind, even your physical appearance will take on that which you have stressed out on. Because when I went on for a year and he told me I wanted to go to San Francisco and go back to the doctor, did an anyway, I volunteered to drive him up. Now, I knew that if I was going to have a baby, I'd know what the time was, as I wasn't. I figured I'd take him up. And we left Los Angeles, drove as I go to San Francisco, keep him up there for a while now. I dropped him off and headed back for Los Angeles. I want to get the hell out of there, too, you know. So I dropped him off, headed back for L.A. And we stopped at the beach and we went to a drive-in movie and we did a lot of things. And I had this funny feeling, but didn't hurt any place. And I think I was tired. You know, I have a doctor friend that told me that I'm going to die from self-diagnosis because I was prescribed for myself. Then I finally got back to Tennessee, and I told my old son Butch that I was going to run down to the general hospital and get something to make me feel better. Now, there's 15 miles of freeway driving between where I was and the general hospital. I drove those 15 miles by myself. I parked in 15 minutes parking, though. And I went to the emergency room, and I told the nurse that I didn't feel well. And she said, well, you're going to have a baby. I said, no, I am not. And we argued all the way up to the floor. And George, my son, is probably the smartest kid I ever had because he knew it was coming all the time. I didn't know until the elevator stopped. But I could tell him that I was parked in 50-minute parking lot, and I had to move my car to a very appealing people. And I finally got my my clothes back, and I was afraid now all owing key to my car, and they would give me the keys to my car. And so when they asked me who I was, I don't cooperate with people like that, and I told them, off yourself. And they did, off the registration of the car. And they sent a deputy sheriff out to my mother's house to ask her to please come down and try to quiet me. You know, by the time she got back there, I was still threatening them what I was going to do to them, but it didn't seem to happen. They sent me badly, baby, I said, I'll be back. They didn't believe me. I don't know why, but they didn't. And why I heard that psycho, I don't know either. But she convinced me that I would go with her that night, that we would come back the next day and get a car. And believe me, I didn't rest until I went back the next day and got the car. But I didn't know until I got down on why that car was so important to me. That car was my means of escape. When things got too heavy for me here, I got in the car and went someplace else. The thing that Alman showed me was the reason that I could never escape in that car is because I was a monster that was chasing me, and I was doing driving. That right car, then I had to write a letter to my job, and tell him I had a new son. This is not an easy nut butter to write, but he bucked off the day before. But I wrote the letter. I sent special little readers, didn't want anything to keep things on. And he got, and he had back to Los Angeles to find out what in the name of heaven was going on. You know, I always seem surprised with certain little things. And on the way down from San Francisco, he was arrested and put off the bus in Santa Barbara. And when he called me on the phone to do something about it, my mother was standing right beside me. And for the first time in my life, my mother gave me an order that I couldn't refuse. She said, you do one thing to help him, and you don't need to call me ever again. And burned my hands from the bush. So I just told him there was nothing I could do. And he spent a weekend in the jail in Santa Barbara. And we went before the judge on Monday morning. The judge happened to have heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, which had just started in the Santa Barbara area. And he was as confused about Eddie's condition as I had been, and anybody knew him had been. He couldn't figure out how a doctor could be so drunk on a bus. The bus driver would pull him out and have him arrested. Or why he would sit in jail during that weekend when he had money to bail himself out. Well, I knew why he wouldn't bail himself out. I didn't bail himself out of anything. He always had plenty of money. He got all his Eddie money. Just so that people wouldn't think I couldn't afford it. You know, that crazy paranoia again. But anyhow, this judge called this entering service of the day and asked him to send somebody over. He won't talk to them. And when he got out there, the judge took the call of my AA and went to his chambers and said to the guy from Alcoholics Anonymous, what do you think he needs? And they said, the guy looked at him for just about a minute and a half, and he said, I think he needs a drink. And Lord John says, that's the first time in my entire life that anyone had actually said precisely how I felt. I did need a drink. So judges, the guy will get to the bus station, he took the ticket. He bought him a drink and put him on the bus. And when he got back to Los Angeles, he said to me, I think I'm going to go to the hospital and do something about my drink. Now, to the best of my recollection, that's the first time that drinking was ever mentioned as being problem or having anything to solve. Certainly never occurred to me. Because some of you have heard, many of you have heard me say, I never came to drink. I didn't want to eat. I'm alcoholic and I'm in quick drinking. I just wanted to learn mine. That was all, you know. And in the days that he went to the hospital, he didn't have treatment. What you had to do was to go through court and have yourself committed. And you were able to do your commitment. And he had 90 days of an alcoholic rehabilitation. And at the end of 90 days, then they called me, into a very official looking office. And he gave me an official looking piece of paper about the day that they wanted me to sign. And I read it. And it said, he had in mind me. Now, I had at that point had about 90 days of Al-Anon, just enough to take my responsibility seriously. And I want you to know that for a long while there, his life wasn't worth living. I would give him just time enough to get to the meeting, so he could have a cup of coffee first. And then after the meeting, he could also have a coffee, but there'd be a certain length of time. He didn't pay any attention to me. I was still doing the same things I'd done before. Because in Al-Anon, at least for me, it was very difficult for me to accept his body. If he had drinking, I had to be under control. I knew pretty much what he was going to do. But then get sober, and call me on the phone, he'd tell me my pocket, and if he wasn't. And I was never mad for him. See? Because my mind would say he won't be here. Like, what? So 8 o'clock is what I was standing on. And he walked in, you know. And he got her notice that I hadn't done laundry. There were a lot of little things that he began to notice. And I guess that's when I really began to want to do something to change the way I was feeling. I many times said alcohol got me here, but to keep me here. What kept me here was that certain something that I have found in Alan. I'm sure you have found in Alan or A, whatever it happened to be. That sort of mystery we never quite conquer, but we taste it once in a while. Just often enough to keep you coming back to see it. Maybe can get it twice next time. When I was new out and I had a lot of trouble drinking, literally, and I believed everybody. Now, that's a miracle. I've often said you have to be kind of careful of what you say to the newcomers these days. And even noticed, because I was in a meeting, and one gal walked up to me, and she said, Leanne, and you have children. I said, yeah, I do. And she said, is your husband in the hospital? I said, yes, he is. And she said, well, have you been to the doctor's office? And I said, no. And she said, we showed the doctor's office. And I said, okay. And so the next day, I called my mother, and I said, I have to go to the doctor's office. And she said, why? And I said, I don't know. But I have to go to the doctor's office. And I asked her she would come out and look after kids while I went to welfare office. I didn't even know where it was at first. I had to look it up. And she got there, I borrowed a car because I thought it looked better than I. And I went, got all dressed up, best clothes, walked into the welfare office and they handed me some papers. And I sat down at the little place they had there and said, how much money do you have in the bank? And I told them, and do you own any property? And I told them, and do you have any cars? And I told them, I'm as honest as anybody could be in Al-Anon. I told them exactly the whole truth. And then I gave the papers back to the lady and sat down. And then I called my name. I went into this little cubicle and there was a man sitting on. I'm embarrassed to think about. This guy was sitting in this little cubby hole with my application. And he said to me, why are you here? And I said, well, I'm in Al-Anon. And he said, yes. He didn't ask me what it was, but I said, yes. And then recently he said, but why are you here? And I said, because I am in Al-Anon. We must spend 15 minutes on that routine until he made me mad that I just put my paper back and went. And as soon as I got home, I called and reported them to my sponsor. And of course, I didn't even know that I had gone out there, you know, because it wasn't she that asked me. But it taught me a lesson that I have used in later life, and that is that I try very hard when I'm talking to a newcomer to explain to them what I'm talking about. You know, because I had also a disastrous call, call. And I didn't know what I was, but still got was very little, and shouldn't speak a whole lot of English, and speak any Japanese. And I thought I made a pretty call her to the hospital, too, but she called me out 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I called her about 11, and she told me she was in the mental hospital, and I said, what are you doing in the hospital? And she said, I just said, but you told me. I said, you did what I told you. And you ended up the second one? I said, if I let me in, because what I had said to her was, you have to be willing to give up everything in order to get this program. And my left, that's what she did. She gave the neighbors everything she had. And my husband came home the house, and the neighbors were carrying it out. And he thought she'd flipped. So we had a minute. And I didn't see awful much after that. She was really kind of one of my failures. And yet, several years after that happened, I got a note from a guidance meeting in Los Angeles. And it was from this little guy. And they just said, thanks, and she was still going down on my thing to me. But I didn't know at that time that, you know, things that we say in English mean something entirely different than that. And she got that joy. It was kind of fun. This is part of the way that I believe we celebrate each day. Not necessarily with our successes, but with our failures. Because I don't know about you, I was not a real quick learner when I was successful. When I was successful, I was inclined to slide. But when I made a mistake, I was inclined to try harder, so I would never have to feel that way again. And that's one of the things my sponsor used to say to me when I was there. How long is it going to go on? And she said, too tired. That's about how I'm going on. I used to be her trial, I guess, because she was a great one to throw in, what do they call slogans, you know. She'd say, first thing first. I don't know what she meant. And if somebody said that to you, what'd you say? And then I decided I better find out what it was, so I went back to bed. And I was working on the room, and she came over, and my kids brought right to the bedroom. And she walked in, and she said, are you sick? And I said, no, I'm working the room. And she said, oh, really, what are you doing? And I said, well, you keep telling me, first thing first. And I showed my report. And I had written up the report, do dishes, make beds, this, that, the other thing. I was swinging around according to their importance. And I could still hear her voice. And she said to me, did it ever occur to you that you had to get up? That wasn't even on the report. You know. But this is just sort of a preview of the complications that an intelligent, well-raised, I'm lifting my ass, I don't have any more, but I haven't got here. And I thought I was so bright, and I was where I could see, because I can understand even the simplest things that they tried to tell me. But I will tell you, the very first time that I knew I had changed, that I had grown and on, was that meeting when I went at the grade, the girl, one of the girls leaned over me, and she said, Vinny, do you know there's a doctor's wife in this group? And I said, you're kidding. And she said, no, there is. And I sat back down after the coffee break, and I watched them. Trying to figure out which one it was, you know. And it turned out to be me. And it was the first time I believed in my entire life that I didn't go someplace trying to be what I thought you thought I should be, which is what I said before. Is when I got here, I was an idiot, so late. And if you don't think it's hard, try to be a PTAer and a choir singer and a older society, something, you know, the telephone saying, hey, you're in a very busy state of mind, because I had a different personality for everything I did, you know. And I don't know why I ever tried it, except that I guess God wanted me as a bad example. That's what my sponsor told me when I, you know, graduated from this outfit. And she said to me, it's up to you, but think over. You know, you may never be a good example, but you can always be a bad one. And I got to think about it, and you're nothing. Being a bad example is a promotion. You know, at least when people say, why are you even saying I'm a bad example? And I take care of it. Anyhow, I'm not sure what else. Any questions you'd like to ask me? I ran out of things to think about. You know, I got a lot of things I did, but I'm not sure what to tell you about. Any questions? Anybody like to ask me? Get me started on something else? Oh. My father? Oh, well, my father, whether I sat down, I used to say that my father was an alcoholic because he did quite a drinking. His drinking bothered me. You know, never bothered my mother, never bothered my brothers or sisters, but it always bothered me. And like I say, when I first got down, I was tall and alcoholic. I could spot an alcoholic 2 miles away. You know, anybody going into a bar, come out of the bar, standing in front of a liquor store. That's looking strange as an alcoholic. And this is a little head of the whole thing, but my oldest son called my father and says, Mom, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And I said, I don't know. I can tell you if you're an alcoholic or not. And he said, why not? And I said, okay, you're not. And he said, well, do you think I am? And I said, well, but I can't really answer that question for you. But I will ask you a question that may help you answer your own question. And he said, what's that? And I said, how many times have you been arrested? It's over. And he hung up on me, so I won't have to listen to him for another 6 months. But anyhow, my dad was a professional. And in that particular profession, as any of you quite all know, the 19th field is very available. And he's not a person that was abusive. He never deprived me of anything. My mother, I think we were discussing it on the way out, I think I had kind of a resentment against my mother. Because I knew that she could make him do anything that she wanted him to do. And she never ever tried to make him do what I thought he should do. There's another rule for it. If you understand that, you're in the right place, too. The example I use a lot of times is when my dad would mommy, you know, he always ended up on the living room floor. Sit down, lean down, lay down, you know. And she always used to say to us, that's his business. You tend your business and we have no problem. So you used to step over and go about my business. But you see, I should have stepped on because it was during those years, it was not his behavior that bothered me. It was the fact he embarrassed me. I think I must have been a bored song. I can't figure out any way, you know, because I was always trying to make people do what I wanted them to so that I look good. Now, does that make sense to you? You know, and 9 out of 10 times wouldn't do it. I always say that, and it's true, you know, I used to go to my friends' houses and I'd watch their fathers and wish that my father could be like that. And yet today, since I have had a little more son under my belt, I'm trained my drawing of any under the sun, because I had a lot of very good experiences that I was too sick to accept and appreciate at the time. Thank God I got a good memory, because after I got down on and somebody asked me almost the exact same question, you know, because as I say, when I got down, I used to refer to my father as being a hog. And I was able, because of this program, and because of course, step and few of the things I had to do in order to go in this way of life, I was able to discover that there were very few bad things that happened to me as I was growing up. Most of them were good. But I'm a negative individual. You give me a problem or a happy time, I'll take a problem every time. Because you see, until I got down, I didn't really know how to be happy. I thought happy was something like you had a gift. And I had to be around long enough to find out that at least my happiness is not the culmination of what's going on, but the journey towards the culmination, the fun that I have that I remember. The trip down from the airport, and I was a ball. I mean, we worried about you. But what can you do? You know, it's the things you cannot change. That's the whole thing. And we turned over to God and asked him to give us an excuse, and did, put a student by truck driver ahead of us on our road. But he didn't last long enough for us to use it as an excuse, so we're going to mention it. But the idea of growing up in a family, I talked to him at any company, and I don't know what type of meeting, but you know, I didn't know what type was my age was. And afterwards, this guy caught me in a parking lot, and he said to me, "Do you realize that your father's drinking conditioned you to marry a potential alcoholic, which practically ruined your entire life?" I was almost feeling sorry for myself when he put it that way. You know, and then he gets on a little bit further. I'm getting a little bit too late for some reason right there. Why well, I said it only annoyed because it was something I guess I was supposed to hear, because I said to him, "Supposing I accept your hypothesis that my father's drinking conditioned me to marry a potential alcoholic, which cut me down on, which saved me from that miserable life that I was headed for." I said, "How can you, by any stretch of the imagination, blame somebody who gives you what I have been given because of their illness?" And that's the way I feel about it. I had a brother that was a little nuts, and I don't know where he is, and I don't worry about him. You know, my mother used to worry about him. And I used to say to her, "Well, I'll go get him if you find me." And then one day she said, "Yeah, I'll go for it." And I said, "Bye, so we're doing great." You know, at one time I would have been able to admit that. Because I would have had family that, I got some good luck this, you know, but I got this one happen. And I don't know he's doing anything bad, but I don't know where he is. I don't think, you know, that my mother and father have passed away, or that my sister and my brother have passed away. But that's not my problem. See, that's one of the bonuses that I got right here in a room like this with people like you. And that was that I don't have to be unhappy unless I want to. There's many things that can make me unhappy. This sister of mine, she was very, she had a problem with alcohol, I believe. I grew up a little, and her own something lesson that I will never forget, because when she first told me she wasn't feeling well, and she lost a lot of weight, I said to her, "Well, if you change your life, you probably might not. You'd get better." And that was about in February. In May, her daughter called me, and she said, "Emily, would you please go up and talk to my mother? I can't get her to go to the doctor, and I think she's very sick." And when I went up to see her, she was in the final stages of pancreas cancer. Although we didn't know that at the time, I took her to the hospital that day, and she lived 3 weeks after that. But she taught me a lesson that I hope I never forget, and that is, don't, for me, try to think that you know, just because the drinking was an obvious ailment, it wasn't the drinking, it was a sip. If I've ever had a sip in my life, I had that day, when I allowed my snobbish attitude toward drinking to deprive her of what might have helped her, or might not have helped her. I don't agree about it, don't misunderstand me. In fact, I have two main aunts in New York that wanted to know taking them out because their age, they wanted me to write the detailed letter about everything that I did. And Peggy, knowing she was going to die, had set up her own arrangements. And one of the things she said she wanted was to have a place in Forest Lawn that was close to the freeway. Because then she'd never be lonely, I told you, but that's the way she wanted. And that's what she got. So when I wrote and told these aunts that information, and one of them wrote back and said to me, "Well, how close is she to the freeway?" And I wrote back and said, "Dear Aunt Winfrey, we have no earthquake, she'll be the right-hand lady." And I know there's some people that may sound disrespectful, but the truth, you know, and these aunts don't think I'm sick. Only now is the medic quite as careful. They keep saying to me, "You do strange things since you joined that organization, you know, and I do strange things, I tell the truth, and other things, you know, I used to lie." But anyway, it's fine. You had a question back there. Oh, yeah, so what did my husband wrote? When he went to the hospital, up to Camarillo State Hospital, he had to agree to attend AA meetings. And it was at an AA meeting that he heard about Alan. And he's the one who wrote the letter to the Al-Anon bosses and told those complete strangers that there was something wrong with me, you know, the nuts at the Camarillo State Hospital. So one day, once that I just could not believe that he would do something like that to me. You know, it was, "Have you ever visited anybody in that house when you're well?" Yeah, and you hear that door closed behind you, you know, tear the lock like. And then look around, all them nuts look just like you. You know, and the first couple of times I went there, I used to think, "Oh God, I hope they don't face the already freaked out." Because the first thing I did was ask them what his name was, so it would kind of strike a friendship, you know. And I took the porch of the damned, I tell you, but I, all those experiences were necessary. You know, the only people that I really thought were okay with the cycles, you know, I could tell a nurse from that. And Eddie was helping the dentist. I could tell him, you know, I could get him to work for nothing, and this and this, Eddie worked on all these nuts. And he'd say, "Well, he deserves it, you know, I mean, after all." But it was an experience. He got a job there too. He was washing dishes in an employee's dining room, because they had food. And oh, God, forgive me. All right, one boy made it, and he got in the car, and he said, "Wait, bye down here." So I drove him there. He said, "I'll make a laugh, and I made a laugh." And then he said, "I made a laugh. He said, "Stop, and I stopped." He jumped out of the car and ran down to the bush, and I thought, "Jesus, Mary, and Joseph." Now, he just really flipped his head. And a few months later, he came back, shaking his head, and I thought, "What was wrong?" And I said, "Are you sick?" He says, "No." He said, "That's real nice, divided plates in the dining room, and I thought maybe the kids would like me, so I hid some mush, but somebody caught one." You know, I never deserved one another. I don't know how we got together, but we deserved one another. And it was something else. That's how I got down on. The man down on is wondering how I did it, too. They went out of that hole. It's it's one of those things. But, anyhow, it's, anything else? I don't know. no lessons. I'll be better tomorrow. Right now, I'm still riding that cat's car. But, I don't know why I wrote all this. I haven't said one of them things on the paper yet. But maybe I saved you awesome. You know, I could have said all this stuff in a thing to you now that I read it over. Do you ever do that? Do you ever write things and then you go to do mail them? When I was about a year and a half now, my sponsor, whose husband was one of these oil policemen, she came up to Oregon. I hated Oregon for a long time because I couldn't believe that she'd leave me in the midst of my illness. Because that's one of the first things they tell you when you go out and you're sick. I didn't really believe them, but they wanted me to be sick. I was well to be sick to stick around, you know. And when she went to Oregon, I used to write her letters 2 or 3 days, only mail and 3. But I didn't know then the therapy that you can get by sitting down and just writing how you feel, or what's going on, or a letter to somebody, or whatever. But just being able to communicate with yourself with a piece of paper, at least for me, was good. Will gave me that as a lesson. One time she told me to write letters to God. So I thought it was nice. I talked to him all the time, but I'd never read it before. And I sat down and I'd write, "Dear God," and then I'd write how the day went. And she used to say to me, "After you write them, after you read them, print them." Well, I'm a collector type. I mean, I've never thrown anything away in my whole life. I get out of that, I lose something. And I used to keep these things, you know, and I had them in my purse because I let somebody else find them. I was writing to God, and I was going down the freeway, and some dummy just swerved in front of me. I had a hit brick and look, I was going to hit the side of the writer, you know. Now, I wasn't afraid of getting killed or ripping bar. I was afraid I'd get knocked out and they found them. Letters to God and put me in a psycho ward someplace, you know. So as soon as I found out I wasn't going to die or get hurt, I'd only burn those darn letters. And that is fun, isn't it? It's great to be alive, to give myself a break. Hey, what would you say today is? You agree with my song to this now? Yes. So do I. Because this is probably the most important time in our life, right here, right now. I'm not sure why I'm here, but this must be where I'm supposed to be, because this is where I am, you know. And that has cut down a great deal on my worrying about the way things are going to go, or what's happening around me. You know, I didn't have a worry in the world, and I just got off the plane flying, and Kathy was right there, and we went to Salem, and Kathy was right there. Sounds like I'm stuttering, but I'm not there, but Kathy. And then we head up here, you know, and I'll tell you one thing, Oregon's got a whole lot of trees. I've never seen so many trees in my whole life, but they're beautiful, you know. And thank God, because the place like this, and people like you, I can see the beauty. Not just in the forest, but in the trees. Halfway up here, I discovered that the river had been running the wrong direction. And I just happened to mention to Kathy, I thought we were rolling uphill, the river was running. No, we were rolling downhill, and the river was running uphill. And she said, it's running downhill. And I watched it for about 4 miles, and I still thought it was going uphill, you know. But that's okay, see, every time I've had to do a little research on that. But today I can take her word for it and enjoy the river, and it doesn't make a lot of difference. So I guess that's all for me for tonight. Hopefully tomorrow I'll make a little more sense. And I want to thank the committee, Raven, Kathy, and all of you for inviting me up here to do whatever I'm supposed to do. And tonight I'm going to pray tomorrow. If you don't like those, I can blame him, because I'm turning it over to not. That's all it's good.
This is the end of session one. Start of session two.
Morning, everybody. Morning. I hope it is. I say that every morning. It's just like when people say to me, how are you? And I say, fine. I know if I say it long enough, somebody will be telling me absolute truth. And, but this, I just can't get over this place. I really can't. I'm in some beautiful places, but never any place where they love you to sleep with a, you know, rain, yes, but never know. I am talking to some of the gals over in the dining room this morning about miracles. And I've always believed that my coming down on was a miracle, because it was one of the things that got me into again. I'm one of those people that can never do anything a little bit. If I get involved with it, I have to go to the end of the road, even though I know that there's a block when I get there. I still have to keep going in order to survive. And so I think that people are glad they got me to Al-Anon was a miracle, because I don't know whether you're familiar with Dr. Writing or not. But I still have letters I got from him in 1942 that I haven't been able to decipher. So the fact that they could read in the Al-Anon office and find out what it was that he was talking about is a miracle. And I went to my first meeting. The guy that was leading the meeting was a person who had 6 children. I had 8, so there's an identification there. She wasn't any happier about than I was, so there was identification there. And her mother-in-law was supposed to have been the speaker. And she happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the last minute called Marty to tell her that she had gotten a 12-step call she was committed to, so she wouldn't be able to speak. So Marty was mad at her mother-in-law, so there was another identification. Well, she smoked my friend's cigarette, so. And I look back, and I find all these various sundry things, but I think the miracle of the whole thing was that her mother-in-law was the woman that I had been on the altar society with at St. Augustine's Church. And I had fought with that woman for 3 years. We had the craziest mix-up altar you ever saw in your life. I didn't know Irene was drunk, and she didn't know I was crazy. And we were both rather strong personalities, and so the priest never knew we were going to have the same kind of powers on both sides of the altar or not, because it depended on whether we compromised or whether one of the other us won. But I truly believe that I walked in and seen Irene sitting in that room, I would turn around and walk out, because I didn't have to be involved with her anymore. You know, I prayed this every time we went to Mass. And so as I look at things in retrospect, I believe that my entire existence, as far as Al-Anon A are concerned, has been one miracle, or maybe a coincidence, you know, after another. I like the definition I heard one time in the meeting. The coincidence is a minor miracle in which God chooses to remain anonymous. And I like that idea, you know. When I got down on, as I told you last night, and if I'm a free people, maybe I suppose I didn't sit there for the first time, but I was not all that involved with the 12 steps. You know, in the first place, it didn't tell you how to work. And they talked about working the 12 steps. And I didn't see any instructions. And besides that, most of them didn't make any sense. You know, the first one said, I'm powerless for alcohol and my life has become negligible. Well, if you're an intelligent nature, you can figure that out right off the bat, you see. I could take alcohol and live alone, and have been him, I'd have been. So I figured that was his step I looked for. And I continued that, you know, I was smart enough not to tell them that I had skipped the first one, because I met people in that meeting that really, under the first step I were not, but there was a chance of recovery, that they needed it, because these women, not their fond women, you know, I think because of the competitiveness, you know, I always felt like I was competing with them. I don't know what the prize was, unless it was that thing I was married to. But I really don't think I saw the man I married until I got out of line, you know, because I'm not sure I made a great choice, but that all these side points, you know, I thought it was tall and handsome and short and pudgy now, but I never really saw him. And my sponsor, you know, she said, take the first step or whatever, and I said, oh, I have. And I've never been tallest for anything. I just never felt that there was something I'd do about something that would make it a little bit better. You know, I never knew that my solutions were really my problems. And so I kept getting worse and worse after I came down on them. Because I was losing the ability to play the game, and I didn't know it. And I would go in those rooms, and they'd be happy and laughing and talking. I didn't really have a big problem that he wasn't at home. And I did pretty well work in the room while he was in the hospital, because I had those kids regimented where they didn't know what they were doing, you know. And so they weren't bothering me, and Ed was on, so he wasn't bothering me. And so I had to have something bothering me, and the women were the answer to prayer, you know. Because there was one female in that group that I always mentioned when I talked with the nastiest woman I've ever come in contact with. And she was possibly another one of the miracles that I continued to go to Al-Anon, because my first inclination was after. You know, if you've ever, I don't know how many of you have ever been married to somebody who was in the service, but that's one of the requirements is that you're able to outsit most people, because you don't want to be the first highly, because then they talk about you. So you have to be the last highly, so that you do all the talking. And I carried that idea right into the Al-Anon meeting. Goodness, used to look at me when I was new, and she just shake her head, you know. And I can understand that, but I'm one of those people today that I go where I go, and I go comfortably. Now, there's a thing now that has started about dressing. You must be dressed a certain way in order to participate. I don't know if that's got people or you can not, but it's pretty prevalent in California, and I've always been kind of a something or other. I don't know what they call me, but I always say different. And I've never seen a dress code in Al-Anon or AA. And all the stuff I didn't read, but they've got some brainwashed things. You can't get up and share unless you're dressed in tea. Well, I was dressed in tea when I came in, because that was the way it was supposed to be. I was miserable. But I had all the binary, you know. I even did not say not to wear it for a coat one night because there was already one woman there that had one as long as mine. And these were the things that were important in my life. These were the things I noticed. But I almost missed my entire conference one year because I was changing my clothes, you know. Because I didn't know how it was in Al-Anon, but I didn't know that if you wore the same thing to officer wise meeting in the Navy, people talk about you, you know, so you have one dress. And so when I go to somebody today, I don't know, I'll tell them to cover their pants, so you know, I'm show. Because that is the freedom, one of the freedoms that they gave me. But getting back to that first step, I always struggled with that for so long. But finally, my sponsor, in more or less desperation, I suppose, took the word alcohol out of the first step completely. Because she recognized I was allergic to the word. And she put my name in there. And she said, no, word. That's been some 31.5 years ago. And then I stand right this minute and I say to you, I'm powerless over anything, and my life has become unmanageable. It tells me who laughs at my life. It takes away every excuse that I've ever had for the situations that I find myself in. Because it is me who laughs at my life. And it took me a long time before it really sunk in, you know, I'd do something. And realized I had done it without even thinking. It was just so inbred in me to do the wrong thing that I did it without thinking. I did it automatically. And so the powerlessness that I had over my own life because of my own actions.